Good evening, and welcome to KBOO on International Women's Day. I'm Crystal Leedy, and I'm speaking with Micaiah Hart, author of a terrific memoir, My Sweet Wild Heart. Welcome, Micaiah.
Hello, it's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm glad that you could be here. And I think this is a great read for all of us women who enjoy reading another woman's journey to find her true self. It's a road each of us travels, and we each have to find our own way, and you've had some pretty interesting adventures on your own way. You start with your birthplace in Scotland, and the book ends with you in California. Let's start by asking, how long did it take you to write it? Did you start by journaling, or what was your process?
You know, writing for me generally is very easy. Once an idea starts coming, the words just flow. I don't have to work at it. Very lucky that way. Although sometimes the words are a little intense and don't let me sleep at night. But anyway, this book actually was much longer in the writing than most of my books. It was very cathartic for me to write, and it was really a healing process. And I started it about more than 15 years ago, and it was pretty different in the beginning. But, I wrote it because it was therapeutic for me to write it, and I really resolved some old issues, really finished with them by the writing of them. And I'm very pleased with the way the book finally turned out. I think it appeals to a really wide audience, the way that I managed to write it in the end.
Yes, I would imagine that that's so, because there are so many issues that you deal with, which certainly are issues that many of us as women deal with. And I must say, coming from your childhood in Scotland, where your home was not the place where the children, if they were female, got much emotional nurturance at all. So that really set the road for you. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about those early days and the various things that were going on for you, not only your dysfunctional family, but the creepy guys in the neighborhood?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing to realize is that I was born in 1952, and Scotland was really just beginning to recover from the Second World War. It was still very much a post-war era, and both my parents were very profoundly affected by the war, and as a result, they had really cut off from their own feelings. And they were both very unhappy and depressed people, and there were a lot of very unhappy and unfulfilled and depressed people around. There was a great deal of alcoholism and a great deal of denial. So my father in particular was, he got shot up in the war. He was really a pretty bitter and resentful and angry person, and very sadistic. And he took a lot of his sadism out on me. I was the youngest daughter, and I was an easy target. And there were also a number of men who lived in the neighborhood who felt quite free to molest any young girls who happened to be around. And in those days, you know, sexual abuse was not talked about. I mean, sex wasn't talked about at all. We had no education around it. And I, as a young child, I just came to understand that I had to put up with being touched in ways that I didn't like and didn't enjoy. But, you know, the men around me, as I understood it, that was their entitlement, and I was supposed to allow them to do it, and I certainly wasn't supposed to make a fuss about it. So by the time I was 7, I'd been molested by 3 different men. Two of them were neighbors. One was a friend of the family. And one of the things that happened for me is that I understood that as a woman, I was supposed to allow men to touch me. I wasn't in control of my own life, my own body, my own life, and I really didn't want to be a woman. And when I started developing breasts and, you know, developing a woman's body, I really felt that it was betraying me. And it was many years before I came to terms with the fact. Well, in my 20s, I came to the terms with the fact that I was a woman, and actually, it was great to be a woman. And when I came out as a lesbian in my mid-20s, I really I really was very, very grateful that I was born a woman, and I've never regretted it since. I'm actually, in general, I'm really grateful for the lessons that I learned. Even though my childhood was really horrible, I feel like it really taught me compassion. I really understand what it's like to be a victim, and I have tremendous compassion for people who are stuck in that place, and I'm also deeply, deeply, deeply grateful that I'm not stuck in that place anymore.
Well, yes, it's so apparent how you have traveled from that very tough place. And without wanting to dwell too much on the negative aspects, your story of becoming a lesbian was quite a process itself. You uh-huh. knew as a teenager, for example, what the boys wanted. And until you really found yourself as a woman who loved other women, you kind of had to deal with that in some difficult ways too, I think, or mm-hmm. some tough ways perhaps.
Well, the problem for me was that I was never told that it was okay to say no, and in fact quite the opposite. I was told that it was not okay to say no. And so when I was in my teens, I had sex with so many boys and older men too, and I really it just was so completely unfulfilling, and many times it was just a travesty. It was just very unpleasant. So then in my 20s I began to learn that I could say no, but I've always been a quite a sexual person, and it wasn't okay with me not to have sex at all. And on the other hand, it wasn't fulfilling, it wasn't loving. I didn't have any concept that love had anything to do with sex at all, in spite of the fact that my mother had told me that men's penises grew bigger when they loved a woman. I certainly didn't have that experience. And then when I was 25, and I was working on an organic farm in Wales, and I had an affair with a guy there who was married to a woman who was bisexual, and she knew about our affair, and she was fine about it. And she was quite attracted to me. I didn't take that seriously. I mean, I had thought about the option of sex with women I'd thought about it on a rational level, and it seemed like why would it be any different from sex with men? And then we had an opportunity to sleep together, and we did, and I just kind of removed myself from the experience. It was a sort of a clinical experience. But the day afterwards, I decided to go to Africa, which, of course, when I look back now, I made that decision because some part of me knew that what had happened, what was happening, was really earth-shaking, and I needed to get away from Wales, where I was living. I needed to get away from there in order to be able to deal with it at all. So anyway, to cut a long story short, I met up with the same woman in Norway, and we had a very passionate affair. And for the first time in my life, I understood the connection between love and sex. And it completely pulled the carpet out from under my feet. My whole understanding of reality was turned upside down.
Oh my, yes, that sounds like a very profound experience, all right. And although
yes.
sexuality often is, this came together for you in a
yes.
very big way.
Yes. And over the next year or so, I mean, I had what I think might really could have been diagnosed as an emotional breakdown, but it was really a very, very unpleasant and tricky situation because we had nowhere to go. So we ended up going back to Wales where her husband was living, and neither of us wanted to sleep with him. And, of course, he was furious, and I thought he was going to kill both of us in the night. But what he actually did was he'd always had a real hold over her, and he manipulated her and threatened her, and she went back to him. And I had to deal with being rejected by her and having nowhere to live. And, oh, I mean, it was really a hard time. But I stayed with some friends, and I managed to find other lesbians, and I got to know them. And then for years and years, I lived really having very little to do with men and processing my anger towards men, because I really globalized my anger. And it wasn't for a number of years that I was able to get over that.
Yes, I imagine, too, that, well, I think for all of us it's probably true. We don't have the tools to process the strong feelings that come up unless we do have a model somewhere, and you certainly didn't have it at home, but you began to find better models as you continued on in your journey.
Yes, moving to Northern California was the best move I ever did for myself. It was people in Northern California were much more accepting of who I am, and I did a lot of healing work there. I did some healing work with a woman called Karen McCloskey, who had studied with Angeles Arian. And Angeles Arian wrote a book called The Fourfold Way, which is really about getting in touch with your own personal spirituality. And I did a year-long training in that. And that is shamanic work, I would say. And it involves looking at yourself and looking at what's going on for you. And at some point in that work, we, all of us, had to talk about, you know, how, what our stories were, you know, what were the stories we were holding on to, what were the stories that got us to where we are now. And of course my story was about the way I'd been abused and used by men. And one of the men in the group came to me afterwards, and he was very, very sweet and loving, and he made it very clear that he wanted to be a brother to me and that I could trust him. And of course initially I didn't believe him, but over time I really did come to believe him, and I really was able to move on in those years. I mean, it took years, but I was able to move on from my anger around men and to see that, you know, we're all responsible for the mess that this world is in, and we're also responsible for how wonderful this world is. And there are many very, very delightful sides to being in this world.
And you certainly did have the opportunity to study with some remarkable people and to meet in that studying some remarkable people.
Yes. Later on in my life, I'm 57 now. And in my late 40s, I became very disillusioned with life, even though I'd done a lot of healing work, and I was actually happier than I ever had been in my life before. And I'd had the opportunity to build my own house out of recycled wood, and I had run an organic market garden, all things that I had really wanted to do and loved to do. And I still felt dissatisfied with life. And when I really looked at what was going on, I realized that I don't know that I even put this into words, but I knew that what was missing was a connection to something much greater than just this physical world that we live in. And then I met a woman called Diana John, and there's a group of beings called Amag who speak through her. Now, at that time, I'd known quite a number of channels and psychics and mediums, and I was a little bit suspicious. I didn't feel that any of them were really genuinely any wiser than I was. But with Amag, the first time I met Diana John, and there was a whole group of us there, and she went into trance, and Amag came present into the room, and it was a physical sensation for me. The whole room filled with love and compassion and wisdom. It was a very intense and absolutely delightful experience. And because it was a physical sensation, I couldn't disbelieve it.
Mm.
It was absolutely real. And so I have always trusted Amag, and they have been tremendously helpful to me. When I was going through, in my late 40s, when I was dealing with my existential dissatisfaction, I was asking all kinds of questions like, you know, who or what am I in the world, and why, who put me here on earth, and what for? And they really helped me to find some meaningful answers to those questions. There was nobody else that I came across who could give me answers that really meant anything to me.
Well, I remember on page, but when you're talking about Diana, I think it's about page 178, you say, "I am unable to learn the steps of someone else's dance. I am mastering the art of self-mastery." And I thought that was very profound.
Yes, we absolutely all are doing that. We're intended to be doing that. And you know, I know there are plenty of people who find it valuable to become a Christian or a Buddhist or whatever, and that's their path. But it certainly never did work for me. I do feel that it's really important. If people really want to find some deep, rewarding sense of satisfaction, it needs to come from inside.
Yes, and that is such a hard lesson for us to learn, unless we've had some pretty good teachers, I think, and certainly you found the ones that were helpful to you.
Yes, Amok really, they were really incredibly helpful. And, you know, very often I would ask them questions. They wouldn't answer them directly. They'd ask me a question in response to my question. And one of the things they said to me is that you actually can't ask a question that you don't know the answer to. And so they were always helping me to find my own answers. And I really feel like my life has been a process of finding my own answers and a process of learning to trust when those answers came through. And one of the, you know, when I was a child, my father really eroded my trust in the world and my trust in myself. And a great deal of my life has been about learning that actually the world is not a dangerous place. It's actually a wonderful, delightful, and in my opinion, a very safe place. And one of the things you'll have read about in the book is that I am, my kite surfing experiences.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. It's not that I expect anybody else to, you know, expect everybody else to rush around doing that kind of thing, because kitesurfing is quite an extreme sport in many ways. But for me, it was intensely, educational to be able to dance with the water and the wind, and absolutely delightful to do that. And, you know, it is potentially a dangerous sport, and I have found that what I need to do is to listen to myself. And if my body says, okay, today I'm too tired, then I'm very careful. You know, I don't go out when my body says that. But you have to be able to listen to your body. And in this day and age, so many of us don't have good relationship with our body. We don't know how to listen to our bodies. And the truth is, the body is an incredible source of wisdom. And we need to learn to listen to it.
It's quite true, I think, what you say, that between advertising and the culture in general, and I suppose perhaps more true in Great Britain than the U.S., but the conventional wisdom tells you to trust not your body, but your mind, and only the rational part, of course.
Yeah, the rational part, right. Well, it was the year 2000, actually. I had an accident, and there was a precursor to this, where I had been dealing with all these existential questions, and I'd been, you know, I'd really come through a lot of my healing work, and things still didn't feel right. And I made a commitment to whomever you make these commitments to, that I would do whatever it took to live in a place of joy in my life. And a few days after I made that commitment, I was riding my horse and I fell on my head. And I lay unconscious in the dirt for a couple of hours, and it was December, so by the time I woke up, I was very cold. It was dark and I was very cold.
Yes.
And I woke up very slowly, and I knew that my body was in trouble, but, you know, I didn't remember who I was or where I was. I just knew that I needed to get help. And then I realized that I was down the driveway of my house, and therefore that meant that the nearest help was half a mile away, and I couldn't even walk. And in the instant that I realized that, I found myself lying in the house down the hill, and the woman who lived there was telling me she'd called an ambulance. So anyway, everything was fine. I had concussion, but, you know, I was fine.
But you don't know from the rational part of your mind anyway, how you got from that right. one place to a place where you could get help.
Right. And I certainly hadn't physically walked or crawled because it was a very steep path down the hill and it was completely dark. And I didn't have a scratch or a bruise or I didn't have any mud or anything on me. And if I had gone there physically, I would have been covered in mud and leaves and dirt and bruises and scratches. So I didn't get there by any physical means. And so then the question is, of course, how did I get there? And, you know, it was a miracle along the lines of a mother who picks up a car when her child is trapped underneath it. In any case, what that experience left me with was, you know, a profound awareness that I am taken care of. And when I need help, it's going to be there. I don't have to worry about, you know, that I'm not taken care of, because I most certainly am.
Well, and that's a long way to travel to come to that realization when you look at, and you've described how your life began, what your early years were
yes.
about, to come to that kind of awareness. Well, it's taken you a long ways, of course. I'd like to bring up a couple of different quotes that I wrote down from the book and maybe have you speak a little bit about some of that. Here on one point on page 196, you said, "We all have access to an infinite source of wisdom. It's a matter of learning to let it flow through you." And I think you've already spoken a bit about this, but is there more that you would like to say on that subject of
you know, people in this world, so many of us are looking externally for other people to tell us what to do. You know, we feel like there's something, there must be some way of finding out whatever it is we should be doing. We're uncertain of what we should be doing in the world, and we're looking for an external source to tell us what we should be doing. And the truth is that the reason we exist is to be who we are in this world. And so the only thing you have to do, and of course I don't mean that it's simple, though, but it's true, the only thing you have to do is to find out who you are and be who you are and dance your own sweet wild dance. That's the purpose in our existence. It's the purpose in being born. It's the purpose in being in human form. And that's what will be fulfilling. Ultimately, that's what will be fulfilling for each and every one of us.
Yes, and yet, as you say, we may not be aware of that for such a long time.
Yes.
You were able, fortunately, through your, shall I say, willingness to go out there and find out who you were, even though it may have caused you some unpleasant experiences and physical and as well as emotional pain, but you were willing to do that. So there's a bit of that need to be willing, don't you think?
Yes, and we need to differentiate. Well, we're back here really to, you know, we grow up, we're taught that the world is a dangerous place. And so we must, you know, we've got to have insurance, and we've got to have a house, and we've got to have a partner, and that belief that the world is a dangerous place and that we've got to do these things to make sure that we're going to be okay, what that basically means is that we're motivated by fear. And it's absolutely vital, it's very important that we stop doing things that are motivated by fear and learn instead to be motivated by trust. And that really requires a tremendous amount of introspection and a lot of courage, because, you know, when you first start out, we are afraid, and we have to decide that we're not going to let that fear motivate us. And we have to choose to look to find what brings us joy, what really truly brings us joy. And it may be that what brings us joy is, it may be that other people disapprove of that. I mean, I know that a lot of people think that kite surfing is a selfish thing to do. It's selfish, you know, it's selfish of me to spend so much time and money doing something that just brings me joy. And my answer is, you know, when I'm in a place of joy, then that's infectious. It spreads to other people.
Yes, it's a gift to others, I imagine.
It's a gift to others. And when I'm feeling that very intense delight that I feel when I've been kite surfing, it benefits the whole world. It benefits everyone. You know? So we each need to find what brings us delight.
Yes, well, probably a lot fewer of us may choose the kite surfing, but yep. The idea is certainly very valid. We've got to find our own love and our own, what gives life and meaning to our life.
Yes, our own heart's desire.
Yes. We've been speaking with Micaiah Hart, author of My Sweet Wild Dance. Micaiah, before we finish, let me ask, what's next for you?
You know, I have a lot of books on my computer. I'm an inveterate writer. I can't stop writing. And the next book that's going to be published is called A Different Rhythm, and it's about my travels in Thailand and in Indonesia. But I'm also, actually it's almost finished, but I'm in the process of writing a book called The Art of Being Human. And that's a short book, and it really is, it's about what we've been talking about. It's about how to be fully present in this life, to be fully human, and to find joy in life. And that book, I'm hoping that book will be out this year. And in the meantime, I've actually already started coaching people in the art of being human. And I'm really enjoying that work. It's really delightful.
Well, we're really delighted that you could join us today. We've been talking once again with Micaiah Hart, author most recently of My Sweet Wild Dance. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us here on KBOO.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.